This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Reedy Press has put out a new edition, which takes a look at Northwest Indiana attractions, that, of course, just outside of Chicago. Ones that maybe you've been to, maybe you haven't. But it's one that if you were creating a bucket list, this is definitely a book to check out to make sure that you don't miss anything. And, of course, we have Joe Pete, who is a business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana and an author in his own right for other books as well. He's with us. This is his latest edition. It's come out. And Joe, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
What was the idea that you came up with in putting this book together? Obviously, this is just a really great compilation, to be sure, of some of the places that maybe we've been to, but we haven't been to.
My first book came out earlier this year. It's Lost Time in Indiana. That book kind of focused specifically on the past of the region. This book is more about the present of Northwest Indiana. And while that book was kind of narrowly focused on Hammond, this book is focused on all of Northwest Indiana, mm-hmm. you know, ranging from the dunes and the Lake Michigan beaches to Valpo, Chesterton, Munster, Highland, Cedar Lake, LaPorte, just all over Northwest Indiana and the greater Calumet region. It's filled in with even a few entries in New Buffalo and across the state line in Illinois, like Calumet Fisheries. It's basically, it was inspired, there was a Chicago Tribune reporter who had written a native's guide to Northwest Indiana a couple decades ago. It's mm-hmm. a great local travel guide. It has a lot of local advice on, like, local cultural institutions and restaurants and that sort of thing to check out. But it's a couple decades old at this point, and there hasn't really been anything, like, fresher published since as, like, a comprehensive guide to Northwest Indiana. And I've always been into travel guides and traveling and going to see places and just kind of hitting the road on road trips. But I've always been big about exploring my own backyard. I've been a big advocate at the Times, like we write the taste test to highlight different local restaurants.
Right.
We had a podcast where we used to make recommendations about cool stuff to see and do. And this book is just kind of like a larger compilation of that. It celebrates a lot of the, like, you know, very popular, well-known attractions in Northwest Indiana, Pierogi Fest, Indiana Dunes National Park, Dark Lord Day, Albany's Candy Factory, things of that nature, but it also celebrates the rich ethnic heritage and a lot of the foods we have, like lemon rice soup, gyros, tavern cut pizza, you know, smaller, lesser known things like Kielbasa Fest. There is a, it highlights kind of like out of the way things, like that there's in Hammond, they go read a Robert Frost poem on the darkest night of the year. There's a truck stop in Cary that's been recognized by Food and the Balkan Grill, just mm-hmm. off of the Borman Expressway, that's
yeah.
been recognized by Food and Wine Magazine as serving the best Juicy Lucy or Stuffed Burger in the Midwest. It tells you about, like, a lot of off-the-beaten-path stuff like that, as well as, like, well-known region institutions like Shoops and Minor Dunn, and it's filled with little tips and hacks, like if you're at Minor Dunn, dip your fries in the sherbet, things of that nature. But it's a love letter to Northwest Indiana, and it's also a just a guide to getting out there and exploring your own backyard. This is an area where it's very easy just to go up to Chicago and, you know, spend your weekends there. But we have a lot of, like, you know, great museums and restaurants and attractions. You know, like Shrine of Christ Passion or the Heston Steam Museum in LaPorte County, the Gabus Arboretum just across the border from the South Lake Mall. It's got just all kinds of tips of neat things you can do, like to cruise along the Lake Michigan shoreline. You can watch baseball in front of the fiery backdrop of an oil refinery in Whiting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just filled with tips for how to get out there and enjoy the region.
I know that that you've set this up very nicely because it's all broken down into categories so that if you are interested with the book, take a look at the book and you're interested in finding out more. For example, Minor Dunn. I've had the fries and the sherbet, although mine was by accident, but it was good. So it's a nice combination. Yeah, that's a good way to look at different things. Like, I'm interested in some of the attractions for food, or some of the general attractions that are ones that maybe folks that are here in the region that have been here as lifelong residents would know about, but a new visitor to the region would want to check out as well too. And that it's a way to be able to kind of break things down into what you want to do. If you want to go out and look for something interesting and you know that you go through this book and you happen to check out a particular place and you may go back to the book and see if there happens to be a food attraction nearby, you'll maybe find that there too. Make it a good day, I suppose, or even a good weekend.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the book is filled with different itineraries at the end. It tells you different activities you can do by season. It tells you, it has suggestions of itineraries you can do for like, for like a date night or family fun or a foodie frolic or stuff that's free or museums you can hit up or, you know, sports different things you can check out. Like there's the Hoosier Bat Museum in Hoosier Bat Factory in Valparaiso. They used to make bats for big leaguers. So, you know, like Sammy Sosa and Don Mattingly and Frank Thomas hit his 500th home run with that. And you can go there and see how the bats are made. But it recommends like a lot of different fall events you could check out, like, you know, the Haunted Hospital that's so popular, the Labor Day Parade and Lowell, you know, watching sandhill cranes migrate at the Jasper Plaski Fish and Wildlife Area. It's just got tips for all kinds of like wildlife you can go enjoy, like where you can go see bald eagles in northwest Indiana, where you can see bison. Yeah, but it's broken down to be as accessible as possible and to cater to different interests. It just tells you, you know, about all different, like Christmas, you know, it's like tells you all about Petyville and Hammond and the popular Christmas story exhibit and just different things you can do at different times of the year. And it just covers just a wide array of like festivals, like from Dark Lord Day to Festival of Lakes to the Indiana Dunes Birding Festival to, you know, Kielbasa Fest to Pierogi Fest to, you know, the Popcorn Festival in Valparaiso. And it's both like, you know, recommendations, but also an homage to a lot of these like classic region experiences people have had, like getting your toes, dipping your toes in the sand for the first time at the Indiana Dunes National Park and, you know, what it's like to wend through the crowds on 119th Street during Pierogi Fest. And unfortunately, like a lot of this stuff has been canceled this year because of the coronavirus pandemic. This is stuff you'd have to go to, you know, in future years. But some of it, you know, a lot of it recommends like a lot of hikes, like in the Indiana Dunes, that type of thing you can currently do, like while still social distancing and stuff out in nature, you know, different places you can visit, like the Gibson Woods in Hammond, where, you know, you're not going to be out among people.
Mm-hmm. What is the most interesting thing or the weirdest discovery that maybe I should ask that you made when you were putting all this information together for the book?
Oh, absolutely. There are a few just oddball. Northwest Indiana kind of has a reputation for being a weird and wacky place. There are definitely a few contenders for most oddball. There's the aforementioned Balkan Grill truck stop that's gotten like national acclaim for its Juicy Lucy burgers.
Right.
It's been written up by the Chicago Reader and multiple other places. There's Hobart has their annual, you know, duct tape and cardboard regatta where people build cardboard duct tape boats and see which one sinks the slowest. There's of course the Whiting Oil City Stadium in Whiting where you can literally watch flare stacks burn in the background while, you know, a semi-professional baseball game is taking on. There's just a lot of unique stuff in the region, which was part of the reason I set out to write this, because, you know, we're often in the shadow of Chicago and we're not really, you know, fully part of Indiana, and we often kind of get overlooked, especially in kind of guidebooks. You know, we might merit a few entries in something in broader Chicagoland, but a lot of the guidebooks to like Indiana kind of focus heavily on the Indianapolis area. We don't always get a lot like in this region where they're highlighting the unique things, but there's just so much you can explore and so many adventures like right here in our own backyard. This gets into all the, you know, unique museums you can go see. Like you can just go to the old jail cell and the Poco Muse in downtown Valpo. You know, you can see, you know, Frank Dudley paintings and world-class art in the Brouwer Museum. It just breaks down all the different, you know, cultural experiences. First Friday art walks you could do in Michigan City and Miller. And there's just, you know, there's so much you can find to do just right here in Northwest Indiana. I just kind of wanted to shine a light on it, whether it's, you know, coffee shops or Comic-Con or the Chesterton European Market or County Line Orchard or, you know, all kinds, you know, cooking classes, Crown Brew Fest, Munster Ale Fest, you know, catching a basketball game at Valparaiso University, you know, checking out bald eagles on the Little Calumet River. I wanted to highlight, you know, just so many of the local attractions we just have here in our backyard and stuff that makes the region, uniquely the region, our beaches, our casinos, the Michael Jackson home, the Hoosier Theater in Whiting, the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. There's just our region is just rich with history and culture, and I just kind of wanted to celebrate it and promote it.
Well, certainly it's great to read a lot of these points, maybe like I mentioned earlier in our conversation, that you may be a native or you may be a longtime resident of Northwest Indiana, and you may have checked out some of these places, but it's nice to go back in some of them and revisit them and maybe see something again that you may not have seen the first time. And one that comes to mind directly is the Marktown neighborhood in East Chicago. The neighborhood has its own distinctive style of itself as it was created decades ago, but it's now under, I guess, the shadow of the Klein Avenue Bridge. And if they're able to finish it up and get it running so that the traffic can be on it again, then it's going to be make the Marktown neighborhood something to check out again, I would imagine.
Oh, sure. I would encourage everybody to see, because Marktown is under threat by the neighboring BP refinery. I would encourage everyone to like check it out before it goes away and fades into history. It's just kind of a very unique thing that's been in Northwest Indiana for a long time. It's been featured in Ripley's Believe It or Not, and it's got like national attention. It was like in the National Register of Historic Places. It's been named one of the seven wonders of Northwest Indiana, but it was like a master planned like worker community, sort of like Pullman, that was built for the steel mills, and it's completely surrounded by oil refineries and steel mills. But it was built to resemble like this Swiss village, and it was built by a prominent architect who's designed a lot of prominent buildings in Chicago. You know, it's a little worse for wear now. You know, some of the buildings are in better condition than others, better kept up. But it's like was famous for the streets were so narrow, people were parking on the sidewalks and walking on the roads. And they do, you know, annual. You can go there for annual tours. People come down from Chicago. You know, they bike, you know, down, and there are multiple annual tours they host, but it's a very unique, one-of-a-kind neighborhood. There are very few like it that are as well-preserved as it is that are still around today. And it's just something, like, unique here, like part of our industrial heritage that people could go and check out. But it's, you know, there's a lot of that, but there's also the book has a lot of, like, nature, you know, the Friendship of Town of Dunn.
Right.
Michigan City you can check out. You know, Lemon Lake, the disc golf courses, there's, you know, all the museums, you know, windsurfing on Wolf Lake in Hammond, how it's been recognized nationally as one of the best places for windsurfing in the country. And there's, like, unique stuff there, like a Nike missile silo. And then there is, you know, some of the more prominent things, like the new Mascot Hall of Fame in Whiting. And just, it just covers so many different areas. And, you know, whatever your interests are, there's probably something in there that you know, find interesting, whether restaurants or, you know, museums or galleries or shopping places or, you know, just various institutions. And with the restaurants especially, I tried to be all-inclusive. I tried to do, like, broader categories like Lake Perch and Lemon Rice Soup Italian beef, and just cover as many local restaurants as possible and, you know, give suggestions to where to find, you know, good traditional tavern cut, you know, square cut pizza, you know, those types of things, and how to best get out and enjoy your time in Northwest Indiana.
Well, from Lemon Lake to Lemon Rice Soup and lots of other things in between, you're going to find dozens, literally 100 things to do in Gary in Northwest Indiana before you die. That's the title of the book that Northwest Indiana Times business writer and author Joseph Pete has put out. It's published by Reedy Press. It's available now from the publisher, and also to check out local bookstores. They'll have copies available too, starting in the month of October. And Joe, thanks very much for running down almost literally all of these great items that's on this maybe a bucket list that you might create here that you have to check out before you die here in Northwest Indiana. Thank you for talking about them today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Speaking of the book signings and events involving the 100 things to do in Gary and Northwest Indiana before you die, the first of the series of book signings and presentations will be coming up on Saturday, October 3rd from 11:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. It'll be at Miles Books in Highland. And then after that, on Saturday, October 10th from 2 to 5 p.m. at the Green Door Books in Hobart. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. In the last week, President Trump has committed $13 billion to Puerto Rico. He's also named a Cuban-American Latina from Miami to his short list to replace the late Supreme Court jurist Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Some say the moves are to court the all-important Latino vote, which is expected to be the largest voting bloc after whites. To some Latinos, voting for Trump is unimaginable because of what they say is his hateful rhetoric. But to Trump's Latino supporters, they say his policies have helped the community. Michael Puente reports.
Indiana has never elected a Latino to Congress. Mark Leyva hopes to be the first if he wins in November. He's a Trump supporter, and he's hoping Trump's popularity will help him in his run.
He created a strong economy. He created a lot more jobs, and most of our Hispanics have more money on their paychecks.
Leyva attended a freedom rally in Crown Point last weekend with about 300 to 400 other like-minded Republicans. He was there to promote his first congressional district candidacy. While not many Latinos attended this rally, Leyva, who is Mexican-American, says Latino support for Trump is growing here and across the country. And that appears especially true in the swing state of Florida. An NBC Marist poll this month found Latinos in Florida are evenly divided between Biden and Trump. In 2016, Democrat Hillary Clinton led Trump by a 59% to 36% margin among Latinos in the same poll.
The Latino community sees the actions that this president brought to their families, to their paychecks, to their jobs.
But then there's Trump's rhetoric. His delaying funding to Puerto Rico after devastating hurricanes in 2017, children kept in cages along the border and being separated from their families, building the wall, and threats to eliminate DACA protections for thousands of young Latino adults who were brought to this country illegally when they were children, actions that are abhorrent to Latino Democrats.
I think their initial reaction is that I'm kind of a traitor, actually. Yeah, like, what do you mean you're Republican? Like, and you support Trump? He's a racist.
Laura Vasquez, a 53-year-old Puerto Rican, says her political beliefs have cost her.
I have lost so many friends because I support Donald Trump. A lot of friction, a lot of eye rolling, a lot of snickering behind my back and not talking to me because I support Trump.
I would just warn against seeing Latino Republican support for Trump as some kind of like self-hatred, self-loathing, selling out, some sort of betrayal of your race. I just don't believe that Latino conservatives see themselves this way.
That's Gerardo Cadava, a history professor at Northwestern University who penned the book The Hispanic Republican. He says it's no surprise that Latinos vote for Republicans, and that includes Trump.
Over the past 50 years, about 30% of Latinos have voted for the Republican Party. So, you know, as a historian, I can say that's a pretty consistent pattern, and we'll see. But, you know, if I had to guess right now, I would expect that Trump will maintain his support or maybe even grow it a little bit.
But even Cadava admits it's hard to understand how Trump has managed to attract Latinos even while, at the same time, insulting them.
It's a head-scratcher. It's totally a head-scratcher.
In 2016, according to a Pew Research Center paper that year, on national exit polls, Trump got 28% of the Latino vote. In this presidential election, according to Pew, there will be 32 million Latinos who are eligible to vote. And while news reports obsess over immigration, Cadava says for many Latino Republicans, that's not their main concern.
Immigration and the border rank comparatively low on their list of priorities compared with jobs, education, healthcare. And on those issues that they say they care more about compared with immigration, there are conservative positions like school choice, like anti-abortion and tax cuts.
Although people may say what they say about Trump, but you know what? He's the only one that actually stands for what I believe.
Nelson Velasquez is a retired police officer from West Suburban Glen Ellen. His parents arrived from Puerto Rico to the Chicago area in the late 50s. His mom was a nurse at Jackson Park Hospital, while his dad ran a bodega, a small grocery store near the hospital. Velasquez's father also ran a nightclub on the south side called Angels. Velasquez says there's a lot of rhetoric in politics, but Latinos who support Trump are more focused.
They think about their pocketbook issues, what affects their families, their property taxes, crime in the area. I am one of those individuals, and there is a slew more of Latinos who feel just like I do. That's why you have so many different Latino for Trump organizations. They're out there.
Bottom line for Velasquez, he says if whites are allowed to vote for whatever candidate they want, and support causes important to them, so can Latinos.
People are tired of being shamed and who to vote for. We are not cattle. We are people. We are single-minded, thought-thinking individuals. We are not the masses. I don't need to vote for a particular person just because I'm Hispanic. Anybody who would tell me that, I look at them and I'd say, you know what? You need to dig a little deeper and be a better representative of your people.
Today, Trump was in Miami participating in a roundtable discussion with Latino business leaders. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Michael Puente.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I lived in a town that was very against welfare, to the point that I had people in my econ classes saying that it's social Darwinism, everyone on welfare should just get taken off welfare and they should die. All was awful, especially when my teacher agreed with it. Like, he was just like, oh yeah, yeah. I was just like, man, like, that's really hurtful because I'm on it. We had this thing called a fishbowl. So we're all sitting in a big circle and then there's a little circle and we're discussing things. And I was discussing welfare and I was like, this is actually the truth of welfare. Like, you get a $100 welfare check. You only get so many food stamps a month for this many people in your family. You get Medicaid, but it doesn't cover hardly anything. And they'd be like, well, why don't you just sacrifice $100 welfare check and go get a job? And I was like, well, you can't just do that. If I'd gotten like a full-time job, like, I would become the main income in the family. We'd have lost food stamps, we'd have lost our insurance, we'd have lost everything. Then I would have had to drop out of school to support my entire family. And then I'd still be in the same boat. Like, I'd still be on welfare the rest of my life because I wouldn't have a high school education, a college education. So because they were middle class, they didn't understand that that's just not an option.
We're extremely close. We all have had to be because that's essentially all we've had is each other. So there's my sister. She's actually a recent college grad. She's actually doing pretty well for herself. She just bought her own house. Then there's my mom, my dad, and they've always been like really supportive of me and my sister. They're both disabled. My mom has her second brain tumor, and my dad has the blown disc in his spine. You hear, oh, it's the poverty class. They just didn't work hard enough. They're just not doing enough. Well, if they just worked a little harder. My parents work really hard by being the people that they are. My sister will need a babysitter for Kaya when Autumn goes to work. And even though they're in a lot of pain from their disabilities, they'll get up, they'll clean the house, they'll take care of Kaya, they'll play with her, they teach her things. When we come home, if we have a problem, they'll help us deal with it. They'll work really hard with us to fix anything. My sister and I, we weren't very easy teenagers, and they would work really hard to make us better people. I don't blame the students for their interpretations of welfare or what their opinions are, because we're really influenced by our families. And I feel like they just got maybe their opinions from their parent, who were working at Braun Corporation, and they were getting huge salaries, and they got paid vacations and insurance and everything else. So when they'd ask, why don't you just go to the hospital? Why don't you just go to the doctor? They had that luxury. Like, we didn't. We'd have to have the gas to get there. They couldn't see that we couldn't go to church, because that was part of it. We didn't go to church. We weren't part of the PTA. We didn't participate in the community because, you know, you have to have the nice clothes to wear there. You have to have the transportation to get there. Most of the time our car wasn't working. The PTA didn't want my parents there because they weren't part of the community. How could they be? They didn't have any money to participate. It wasn't because we didn't want to, and so they always made us feel really bad about it. But we just have to live through it. Like, that's what we've done our entire lives. We've had struggles, we've had tribulations, and that's what makes us stronger people, is that we push through it and we learn from it.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking at Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. It's almost time to be able to vote, if you have put in your application for a mail-in vote, or if you've already received your mail-in vote, filled it out, and sent it back. It's going to be put into the process. Let's find out how the process is doing here in Lake County, Indiana, at least. Michelle Fehman is the director of the Lake County Elections and Voter Registration Office, and she is with us for an update. And Michelle, thank you for joining us today.
Not a problem. Happy to be here.
Well, I understand it's a whirlwind of activity over there at the county government center these days, especially in your office, as people are getting a chance to open up the envelopes that people have sent in their absentee ballots, and you're getting them all put into place here. Tell us first how the activities are coming along here. Where do we stand right now as far as absentee ballots are concerned, and what is the procedure that is going to be going through now ahead of Election Day?
Okay, so let's start with the procedure first and how to even apply for an absentee ballot.
Okay.
So voters can go on a number of different places, and one of the easiest spots, and this is a great website for people to use, and it's www.indianavoters.com. Now, on this website, you can register to vote, which, of course, in order to be eligible to vote, you have to be a registered voter.
Mm-hmm.
And so registration closes on October 5th at 11:59 p.m. So it's important that you register to vote right away. From there, you can also, on that website, if you are a registered voter already, you can apply for an absentee ballot. It comes right through our hopper, and we process it the very next day. You can also see on this website what your precinct is, where your polling site is, and the candidates on your ballot. So it's a great wealth of knowledge coming in one little spot. Now, of course, you can also go to our website, which is thelakecountyin.org. But there it's a little bit more limited. You cannot apply for your absentee ballot there. It would direct you back to that indianavoters.com.
I see.
So, but you can see on our website, you can see a list of polling places, you can see the precincts, you can see who the candidates are, and so forth. So those are two great spots to start with. But okay, let's move on to when someone applies for an absentee.
Okay.
When a voter applies for an absentee, it comes to our office, and then we look you up in the system, to the statewide voter registration system. We make sure that you're a registered voter, and then we will begin the processing. Once we approve and accept the application, that ballot will go out the same exact day. And we've been working 12-hour shifts here every single day, making sure that these ballots are getting out as timely as possible. We do get about maybe a little over 1,000 applications a day, probably more. We're getting about 500 to 600 applications online through that indianavoters.com page, and then we're also getting another probably 1,000 in the mail. So on average, we're processing about 1,700 to 1,800 ballots a day. Those go to the post office, and then they go out immediately. I will give some kudos to our post office. We've met with our postmaster a few times. The very first day that we mailed out, which was Friday, I believe it was the 18th, and we mailed out over 10,000 ballots on that day.
Oh, my gosh.
We had people posting on Facebook that they had already received their ballot as early as Saturday morning. So our postal system is doing a great job here in Lake County on getting the ballots out, and we have already received a huge number back already.
Mm-hmm.
So in regards to where we're at in stats, we have mailed out over 25,220. And again, we're processing more today. Of those, 5,943 ballots have already come back. We will definitely go over 6,000 today. Post office has already called me. We've already, we're probably en route right now to pick up. So we'll be over that 6,000 mark today in regards to ballots received. Once they're received, we pull the application again, match that up, we verify signatures, and then the ballot is held until Election Day, at which time they are opened on Election Day and counted. New law this year is that if a person's signature, if we notice right off the get-go that the signature doesn't match or the voter did not sign, they will get a letter from me asking them to sign a sworn affidavit, and they will return that to us that will assist in the counting process.
Mm-hmm.
And on those, they actually have until November 11th to return those. So some of those ballots, if there were missing signatures or no signature, after the election may be considered as a provisional ballot and giving them a little bit extra time to get that signature into us.
Does having this process, even with the changes in the law, does that help smooth things over? If people have forgotten for some reason or, you know, whatever that the case may be, to be able to get at least the application all the way through, get to the ballot, and then get the ballot at least set aside so that come Election Day that it'll have to be taken up, I guess, after the Election Day count is done?
I think it's a good process. First of all, it's allowing that voter to correct an error, and especially when we know about it, you know, a month and a half in advance. If I see one that comes in with no signature, we should be notifying them that, hey, we saw that there's an error. This is how you can fix it. And so I think it's a great thing for the voter. Last year's primary, we rejected about 700 ballots for signature errors, and 700 votes can determine an election one way or the other,
right,
by for sure. And so when we're knowing these things in advance, we should be doing everything in our power to make sure that we can correct it and it should be fixed. Now, we did say that it could go all the way till November 11th for them to return that to us. Keep in mind, this year is probably going to be an all-time high with absentee ballots. We've already by far bypassed anything we've done in the past with relation to where we're at in the time frame. As an example, on the first day that we mailed out, which would have been that Saturday, we actually mailed out one day early just because there was going to be a power outage here at the building and we weren't quite sure if we were going to be able to use the elevators.
Right.
So we started mailing out on Friday, and we mailed out over 16,000 that day. Our next highest vote, so we mailed out actually 15,562 on the first day. Our closest total to that on a first day ever was back in 2008, and I believe it was at like 3,500. So in the first day alone, we mailed out 12,000 more ballots than we've done before in the past.
Yeah, this is, to be sure, it's extraordinary. This has been an extraordinary poll process. Actually, even going back to the only other reference point that you have is the June primary election. Things got delayed until June this year, and you had all those that you had to deal with as well. Are you finding that that's probably your reference point, that the primary election gives you kind of a clue as to how it's going to shape up going into election night?
Yeah, a little bit. So in the primary, we had about 30,000 absentee ballots cast. Based on what we're seeing already, we're anticipating probably 50,000 for this general election. Generals are always going to be higher than a primary, of course, because primary is a nomination, the general is the final. So for absentees alone, we're going to see a lot more, which means people may not know the final totals on Tuesday night.
Right.
With 30,000 absentees, we were here till 2 a.m. in the morning. So with 50,000, what our anticipated number is, we're anticipating that we are going to be prepared for counters to work on Wednesday and Thursday also.
I have heard that that's likely to be the case, that people should just expect. Maybe you may get some clue by the end of election night, but only that. It's not going to be anything nearly close to being even unofficial. It's going to take a while, and I know it's going to, by the time you get all these absentee ballots put together, and we should note too, I guess, that they get set aside, don't they, by precinct, and they'll be put together, and the count will start in after things close up on election evening?
So the way it works is election night. So throughout the day on election day, we are opening and processing the absentee ballots and feeding them in, and all the early votes, so for all of our 11 early voting locations, those are all input into the system. There are no tallies printed or calculated until 6 p.m.
Right.
So at 6 p.m., you should have all the early votes from all those 11 early voting sites. Those come in fast because they're on voting machines. You will have some that we have already fed in for the paper absentee ballots, but you're not going to have all of them. That's a guarantee. We will not have all those. And then throughout the night, we have totals coming in from the precincts. We have three drop-off locations, and then we have runners that bring them out here. Those cards go in very fast, and they calculate fast. So I am anticipating election night that you will have all the machines, or very close to all of them, from all the polling sites and the early voting. What you will not have completed, most likely, are those paper absentee mail ballots.
Mm-hmm.
Those take some time. And again, with seeing the influx from 30,000 to what we anticipate to be 50,000, we have scheduled employees and counters to be here on Wednesday and Thursday to help us finish up. So you'll have a pretty good idea, but you won't have final numbers. No.
Right. I know that even on a statewide basis, that if things go well at other polling places across the state, that they're not anticipating knowing anything nearly close to being even the unofficial count until Wednesday or Thursday, as you've mentioned here for Lake County. So it's going to just be that way. We just have to accept the fact that we're going to get a clue. We may get a good count if people have gone to the like you say to the early voting sites and done their part by going to the machines, but it's not going to hardly be official. We're just going to have to be patient, I suppose.
Correct. And it's never official until all the provisionals are done, too. So that's the misconception. A lot of people always think that, you know, election night is the final night. We will still have until the 14th, I believe it is, on that Friday, is the last day for people to bring in their photo identifications if they didn't have them on election day and so forth. So your official total is not until once all those provisionals are cast. Now that people can cure their signature, there may be more ballots that are considered provisional than what we've seen in the past, too. So we're just going to have to wait and see what those numbers look like.
How's the staff been holding up, so to speak? As you say, that you've been able to get lots of more help that you can possibly even imagine, I suppose. And everybody's working 12-hour shifts to help be sure that things get done. Is everybody doing pretty well as far as being able to deal with this?
Yes. I mean, I think we're all, you know, pretty excited about the election. We know that we're making history right now with these numbers. So there is an excitement in the office on getting these done and processed and making sure that everybody can cast a vote. We've also been working, the Secretary of State provided us with a large number of PPE items for the polls on Election Day. So for those voters that go to the polling place on Election Day, there will be hand sanitizer, disinfecting spray, we'll have finger cots, we'll have gloves. The poll workers will have N95 masks. Some precincts will have plexiglass dividers. Some will have face shields. Mm-hmm. We will also be providing them with tape to keep social distance. And that will be done at all the early voting sites as well as the polls on Election Day. So we want voters to know that it is, you know, safe to come into the polling places, that we're doing everything in our power to make sure that everything stays clean and sanitized, as well as, like I said, at our 11 early voting centers, mm-hmm. too. We have also increased our hours. So on Tuesday and Thursday nights, we will now be open till 7 p.m., and we will be open on every Saturday in October for voting. Here at the government center, we've increased the number of voting machines. Normally, we would have about 5 in our office. We've moved to the hallway to make it more spacious, and we'll have 10 voting machines here at the government center because we'll have more room now. So we're trying to make it as efficient as possible so that we can move the voters through as quickly as possible.
Well, that's about the best you could expect to find out here at this point. Thank you very much. Michelle Fehman is the director of the Lake County Election and Voter Registration Office. And you've heard it from the boss as to how the process is going. And once again, the early voting opportunities will begin in October. And Michelle, thank you very much for going through this, being patient, explaining everything. And we are all keeping our fingers crossed that there are no glitches, no problems. And we know that we will. It may not be certainly on election night at the end of the night, but certainly, it seems without any barring any big problems, not long after that, a few days after that, that we'll have a better count. Thank you for spending time with us, and we will keep our fingers crossed, and thank you for your help today.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Back with you tomorrow.